Hagman Report. We got a special treat for you folks. We have Mr. Robert Blevins. He's the author of a book, Into the Blast, but he's also the head of AdventureBooksOfSeattle.com. He is one of the foremost, and I believe the foremost expert in D.B. Cooper. Folks, you remember D.B. Cooper? He sounds familiar to some of the youngsters out there. Oh, I don't remember that. Or if it does sound familiar, you got to go back in time to November 24th, 1971, the day before Thanksgiving, America's first skyjacking and the only unsolved, in quotation marks, skyjacking in American history. We're going to be getting into that with Mr. Robert Blevins. This is so intriguing. I mean, this is absolutely mind-blowing stuff when you see the mechanism behind this with the FBI and all this. So Robert is joining us by video, but before we get to Robert, I do want to mention that Minuteman Stove. Have you gone there yet, folks? MinutemanStove.com. MinutemanStove.com. Folks, the best rocket stove in the market, MinutemanStove.com. They are absolutely 100% the best. And you know, we all have preps, right? We all have preps. You get your long-term storable food and you know, all things ready in the event of a disruption of power. But you forget sometimes, well, what am I going to cook the food on? Or how? The rocket stove is the most, in my view, the best thing to have for cooking, for heating water, for doing whatever. It takes a little bit of wood. It's like a 50 caliber ammo can that's got refractory insulation on the outside. It's about 14 pounds. Sits on the coffee table. It doesn't get hot on the outside. It directs the heat right to where it needs to be. It's one of the Minuteman rocket stove is the best rocket stove out of all of them on the market. That's why we selected Minuteman. We use it. We have put it through its paces. It's a great deal. Minuteman rocket stove makes the best rocket stoves. They're made in the United States by U.S. workers, and they also actually, they're being used alongside our people in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the Minuteman rocket stove is, to me, is the Cadillac of rocket stoves. You go there, you get fire starters as well. The things to start the tinder. Oh, those things are powerful. But visit MinutemanStove.com. That's MinutemanStove.com. And even after Christmas, if folks makes a good gift after Christmas as well. If we'll say if you've got some extra money and you want to fix your or you know add to your preps, MinutemanStove.com. That's MinutemanStove.com. All right, now I'm going to take you back in time a little bit to November 24th, 1971. It was the day before Thanksgiving, and there was a flight 305, Northwest Airlines flight 305. Guy by the name of Dan Cooper got on flight 305 and handed the stewardess, or at the time stewardess, yeah, we're still allowed to call them stewardesses at that time, a note, said that he had a bomb on board and he wanted $200,000, and that began the this odyssey of D.B. Cooper. And it's interesting, I find it very interesting, if you look back and you watch the Walter Cronkite reports and back then from 1971, a couple of things struck me, of course. 1971, you could walk on with like a, you know, anything. They had no security whatsoever, a domestic flight. You could walk on with a bomb, a gun, a knife, you know, a kitchen stove strapped to your back, and they wouldn't even, you know, no worries. But number two, it's interesting because D.B. Cooper really didn't start out by as D.B. Cooper, as Dan Cooper, D.A. Cooper, as referenced by Walter Cronkite. And then they said a newspaper reported the incorrect initial B, and suddenly the myth of or the mysticism of D.B. Cooper came to be. And Mr. Blevins, of course, being an editor, he was a book editor, is a book editor, and author of many science fiction books, but in his capacity as editor, came across some information from a PI, New York PI, Skip Porteous. And looking at this information back a number of years ago, became intrigued. And because Mr. Blevins lived right in the backyard, essentially, of where this all took place, D.B. Cooper's, where this all took place, Skip Porteous and Robert Blevins kind of began working together. Now, that's kind of just a general summary. But the important thing here is what Mr. Blevins found. Oh, his findings. When you compare his findings to what the FBI is telling you, and his findings to compare to what the History Channel might tell you, or any other of these nonsensical videos out there, in my view, Robert Blevins takes it to an entirely new level in terms of the investigative bar. And that's why I'm so grateful to have him on. Mr. Blevins, thank you so much for appearing on our program.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's nice to be here today.
Well, I'll tell you something. You've done an immense amount of work on this over the past. Well, since John told me that you were going to come on, I just kind of immersed myself in the story of D.B. Cooper. And, this is still classified as America's unsolved skyjacking, yet I believe you did solve it. I believe that based on everything I've seen, you make a pretty compelling case that you have identified the hijacker, not only the hijacker, but the hijacker's assistants. Well, why don't you go back to, first of all, by way of introduction, why don't you tell our audience how you got involved in this? Because I really didn't do that justice. But how did you get involved in the investigation of this matter to begin with?
Well, I was just doing my normal job running adventure books, and people would come with manuscripts once in a while, and then I'd accept him or reject him, perhaps. And Mr. Porteous sent me one about the D.B. Cooper case, and I started reading it, and I hadn't heard of the person he was naming, and I thought there was a few things missing from his book. I said, well, you need to interview the people that this person, your suspect, knew best, and you haven't done that, and maybe you should, and then come back when you do that. Mm-hmm. And then he said, well, he said, you live in Auburn, Washington, and our suspect is from Bonnie Lake, Washington. That's like 6 miles from here. He said, why don't I send you some confidential files on everybody that the suspect knows, and you can go do the interviews yourself. And I thought, well, I'd never been asked to do that before, but I thought, okay, because I was interested in the D.B. Cooper case. I knew I was like a sophomore in high school when it happened, you know, and the SeaTac airport's only, you know, 10, 12 miles from here. So I went out and did these interviews, and I didn't really think I was going to find anything, but I was pretty surprised later by the results.
Yeah, it's amazing how you methodically took the information and just went step by step by step. And not only were you methodical, but you were tenacious as well, because I'd seen many of your videos or where you were cited, I should say, and you had interviewed so many. You had interviewed one witness 7 times. We'll be getting into that. But so that's how you got into it. So, all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So here we are, 1971, November 24th, 1971. Tell us what happened with Northwest Airlines Flight 305.
Well, it was a pretty ordinary day in November, and a lot of people have said there was a big storm that day, and that's not true. I've looked at the historical weather records from Portland and Seattle. It was like mid-40s, ground speed wind maybe 5 to 8 miles an hour pretty much all day. So anyway, the flight landed in Portland. It had come all the way out from Minnesota, and I think it made one stop in Montana. And this gentleman, Dan Cooper, went up to the ticket counter and paid $20 plus tax for a one-way ticket to Seattle. It's like a 30-minute flight. He got on board, and he went and sat near the back. I think it was in 18C, row 18C. And after they got into the air, then he motioned for stewardess Florence Schaffner to come over to him, and he handed her a note. And she put it in her pocket and didn't look at it. She figured it was just another guy's phone number, you know, someone trying to hit her up on a date.
Remember, folks, this is the 70s, okay? 71, yeah, okay.
Anyway, so he called her back over and he said, Miss, I think you should read the note, you know. And she opens it up and it says, you are being hijacked. I have a bomb. You know, I want you to sit next to me. And anyway, it kind of went from there. He made a demand for $200,000. 4 parachutes. The plane went into a holding pattern around Seattle while they were rushing around trying to get the money. They got it finally from SeaFirst Bank. They were able to run all the bills really quickly through what they called back then a Recordac machine and get the numbers.
Okay.
They packaged the bills roughly about $100 to a bundle, $100 bills, and then they brought it to him. And
well, and that's interesting too, because okay, so you've got this aircraft. It was on a 30-minute flight, the leg from what was it, Portland to Seattle, right?
Right. Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. So the flight was going to last about 36 minutes on average, and
yeah,
it was during and this DB Cooper, man of that. Identified as DB Cooper, gets on in Portland, mm-hmm. And yeah, and in the process, and he said it well. He hands this note to the stewardess. Now, another thing too, I like to kind of set the stage. Here's a guy dressed in business attire. He had a clip-on tie, and he sat in the and he said, as you said, in the back of the plane, he was drinking bourbon. They served him mm-hmm. Drinks, drinking bourbon, smoking Raleigh cigarettes. This is when you could smoke on the plane. And, yeah, hands this note to the stewardess, and of course, you know, oh goodness, this is not gonna, you know, he wants 200 grand plus, 200 grand. So anyway, so it goes in the holding pattern, and this is important too, contrary to what the, many of the History Channel people in some books and other things say, it was not a bad day there. It wasn't raining and the winds weren't oppressive or anything like that. It was just a normal day before Thanksgiving weather-wise. All right. And I find it interesting, Mr. Blevins, that, my goodness, there was really little argument. The airline said, okay, we'll give him the money, and arranged to do that through the bank. I mean, there was really little discussion. Yeah, get the money, get it together.
That was because of the head of Northwest Airlines, Donald Nyrop, told everybody, no, we're not going to risk the plane. You know, the plane's worth millions of dollars, and the lives of the passengers or the crew, you know, he wasn't going to go there. He said, we'll just give him the money and what he wants and let him go.
Yeah, and $200,000 back in 71, you got to figure most people were only making 100 and some bucks a week, you know, on average. So that was big money back then. But the thing is, and correct me if I'm wrong, so he wanted $200,000, this D.B. Cooper.
Yeah.
They were going to, in fact, they said, okay, we'll give it to you. And here's a little footnote that I found in my research. He really didn't specify in what denomination, so they ended up giving them all 20s, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Oh, let me think. Was it 20s?
Yeah, I think so.
All 20s.
Yeah. So instead of getting, you know, hundreds and fifties and such, supposedly non-sequential $20 bills. And in essence, if you want to know how much that weighs, 23 pounds worth of bills. 23 pounds.
Okay.
All right. So, and they put it in a duffel bag. Okay, so what happened? So the plane was in the holding pattern, and they were arranging to get the money. And this is about what time is this? Because the plane took off, what, at 2:45, I guess, in the afternoon that day?
I don't know the exact time they circled, but I think they landed sometime after 4:30.
Okay.
Right. And Cooper said a couple of interesting things while they were circling. You know, he told one of the stewardesses, looks like Tacoma down there, you know, which kind of told. And he also questioned the amount of time it was taking to get the parachutes. He thought they would bring them from McCord Air Force Base. I don't think he asked for them to be brought from McCord, but he thought they would come from there. And he said it only takes X amount of minutes to get from McCord to the airport. I mean, it's kind of like he lived around here, you know.
So he's familiar with the terrain.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
He had to be.
All right. And don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, you know, again, 45 years after this, we're not sure. We don't, fascinating story. All right. So ultimately, after this circling maneuver, so he requests 200 grand and four mm-hmm. parachutes. Why four? I mean, why not two or three?
Well, I don't know if he actually said why, but most people believe he wanted to make the people on the ground believe that he might take a member of the crew with him.
Okay.
Because he asked for two main parachutes and two front reserves. So it was actually parachutes for two people. And he did that, we believe, so that they wouldn't send him non-working parachutes.
Interesting. All right.
Yeah.
And is it relevant to ask where the parachutes came from? Because I'm just curious.
That's been documented really well. I've seen the FBI's document on it. Now, for years, the man who packed them, a guy named Earl Cossey, claimed that he delivered them, he owned them. That's not true. He did pack at least some of them. at Issaquah Sky Sports when he worked there. Two of the parachutes came from a guy named Norman Hayden, who had a business in Kent, Washington. And Northwest actually arranged on a rental for them.
All right.
And he sent, what did he send? He sent, yeah, he sent a main and a reserve. And the other two they got from Issaquah Sky Sports from a guy named Lynn Emmerich. And the Washington State Patrol delivered those to the airport. And the other two from Mr. Hayden were delivered by, he got a cab to come to his business in Kent and take, he put the parachutes in the back and gave the cab driver money and said, take these to the Northwest counter at SeaTac. And they're off they went.
Wow.
He,
right.
He actually got one of them back years later too. The one that wasn't used.
The one that wasn't used. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So here we are. Flight 305. Flight
305.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can talk. Anyway, circling and then ultimately lands at SeaTac. And, so what happens after it lands? And here's Cooper in the aircraft with the other passengers. The aircraft lands. The demands are made, for parachutes and money. What happens then?
Well, he did let the, he allowed the pass. Well, he said he wanted to get the plane refueled. He wanted his money. He wanted the parachutes. They started stalling him a little bit on the fuel truck, saying that, oh, it's too cold and the fuel's freezing up or something. And he got a little miffed. He didn't get really angry, but he said, let's get this show on the road, you know, or something.
Right.
And so they finally, and the crew was nervous too. And co-pilot Bill Radizak called down and said, look, you know, fill this thing up. This, you know, this guy's serious. And so anyway, the passengers deplane, stewardess Tina Mucklow, apparently, the blonde haired stewardess, went out and made trips, and she brought in the bank bag with the money and the four parachutes. She just dragged them up there. Then they shut all the doors. Cooper had already shut, I think, most of the windows, you know, the window covers.
Yeah.
So snipers couldn't get him, and turned off at least some of the lights. And he also asked for meals for the crew, which I thought was interesting that he would care about them. But they did bring meals on board for the crew, too.
Okay. And we probably should tell the folks that when he landed at SeaTac, that was not, obviously, he had a, and we're going to get in the bomb, too, but he supposedly had this bomb on board, and he landed at SeaTac. He was planning on, or he told the crew and told everyone, he was, I mean, that was not, obviously, he was planning on flying out of there, so he wanted to fill up in the money in the chutes.
Yeah.
I should go back and ask you about the bomb, because obviously he showed the bomb, which he carried on in a briefcase to one of the, and this is going to be important later, to Tina Mucklow, the stewardess at the time, and showed her what was in there, right? And
it could have been Flo, but I one of them did get a look. Yeah, he showed it to one of them.
All right, and it was, what did it look like?
Excuse me. It was a small briefcase. He only cracked it open for a few seconds. Stewardess said she saw a couple of red sticks in there.
Made her think it was dynamite.
Wires, a battery. Yeah. Wires and a battery attached to it.
Okay.
Then he shut it.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, if I was looking at that, I'd think, okay, dynamite and red sticks. Okay, whoops. Yeah, so.
Well. The FBI always thought, at least Ralph Himmelsbach, the first agent that investigated the case, thought that he was certain that the dynamite sticks were fake, because he said dynamite isn't generally red. He said it's tan colored.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I actually looked that up, and yeah, he was right. I mean, dynamite isn't red like it is in the movies. It's actually tan, yeah, like a manila envelope color.
Okay. Well, nonetheless, the idea was, okay, this guy has a bomb, and I'm glad you brought the name up, Ralph
Himmelsbach.
Himmelsbach, yeah, he was the guy that happened to be on duty at the time, back in 1971. Right, you know, he's in his office. They call him up and say, hey, Ralph, get over to SeaTac. You got a hijacking in progress. So he was assigned the case, basically. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So the crew, okay, so the Flight 305 was moved to the, landed at SeaTac. Actually, D.B. Cooper, the guy known as D.B. Cooper, his demands were met. Four parachutes, as you said, brought in $200,000 in 20s, 23-pound bag, brought into the plane. He let the passengers go.
Mm-hmm.
How nice of him. And kept the crew. demanded refueling, got refueling, got meals for the crew and the flight crew. And, okay, ready to rock and roll. So now here we are, ready to rock, ready to go. So.
Well.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, he made stewardess Tina Mucklow stay on board, but, the dark-haired stewardess Florence Schaffner and the senior stew Alice Hancock, they were able to leave. The flight crew had to stay.
Okay.
So it was just the four guys up front in the cockpit and Tina and him in the back.
All right.
When they took off.
All right. And again, this is a Boeing 727 aircraft, and you have to think back in 1971 too. These aircraft, now think about this because this is important. These aircraft were used in Vietnam in some recon missions or in taking providing materials in Vietnam and such. And they had a backward. This is one of the only planes, I believe, the 727 had a rear facing staircase that you could open in flight that wouldn't really be problematic for or that problematic. It was tried in it was used in Vietnam in their whatever they did there, right?
Yeah, I think they took the stairs off and they put, it was more like a slide, but yeah, it was the same thing.
Same,
down
yeah.
The back, yeah.
Okay, all right. And folks, we're talking to Robert Blevin. His website, of course, is adventurebooksofseattle.com. He's got a page dedicated to this, the D.B. Cooper investigation, which I think everyone should check out. I spent a lot of time there. I was fascinated by this. But we're going back to 1971, November 24th. We just passed the 45th anniversary. FBI says, hey, we don't know. Well, I think they do. And I'll tell you what, Robert Blevin, for everyone to know, he put together a report, gave it to the FBI, and I'll tell you something, it's compelling, and looking at his work product, I would say, man, he's got it. He knows what's going on here. Robert Levin's got the idea, or he's got the goods. So, okay. So, we're about two and a half minutes out, from a break. So, just to be clear, we're ready to rock. Cooper, the flight crew, one stewardess is left on the plane. They leave SeaTac. And what happens then? What does he say? Where's he going?
Well, the first thing is he wasn't real happy about the way the money was delivered. He was a little miffed about it. They gave it to him in like the same kind of leather knapsack kind of thing that armored car guards carry in and out of banks, which looks really obvious, right? They do. Mm-hmm. And he wanted it in a knapsack, he said, and they didn't bring it that way. Well, okay. He opens up the bag. The money's there. He's real happy. He offers Tina two or three of the bundles, and she says, kind of makes a joke. She says, we're not allowed to take tips. So he puts the money back, I guess. And Tina also offered him a piece of paper that had instructions on it on how to use the parachute. And he looked at her and he said, I don't need that.
Uh-huh.
And he looked at the two parachutes. There was the Pioneer Sport model, and there was the kind of pit bull of parachutes, C9 canopy in an NBA container. That's a military parachute. It's a real tough one. He looked at it. He grabbed it right up. And he put it on. Tina said later, told the FBI, he put it on like he knew what he was doing. And he took the other main, I think it was the, no, he took, was it the main? No, he took the other, the working reserve parachute. And he popped the ripcord and he cut lines off of it and he tied those to the money bag, wrapped it several times, and he was tying that on a longer cord around his waist.
Wow.
So it would like hang off his waist.
Yeah, and think about that. So he selected, and the parachute that he did select had significance because it wasn't a military parachute, as you said, or
yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So it was not the best one. Like if you weren't familiar, you wouldn't necessarily pick that chute. And I'm not sure I'd pick any chute, but anyway, you wouldn't pick that one. You'd have to kind of know what you're doing. So that kind of suggested he knew parachutes, right? Yeah. All right. And then he used the cords and straps from the other parachute to tie the money around his back, around his body and stuff. So obviously, yeah, he's fixing to hop out at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you tell the crew to go? I mean, what destination?
Well, at first he said, I want to go to Mexico. They told him, well, you know, you want us to fly with the flaps down and go slower and with, maybe with the stairs down. We'll never make, we can't make it that far. So the crew consulted with Northwest Airlines on the ground. Northwest said, you can make it as far as Reno, then you're going to have to land. And so they told him, well, we can get you to Reno. And he said, okay, Reno.
And that's important to point out, too. Obviously, D.B. Cooper, the man known to be, or as D.B. Cooper said, you're going to fly with the flaps down at 15 degrees and the landing gear down, and that's how you're going to fly. So he was about 200 knots, I guess, roughly, is how fast the plane would go at that, at a lower altitude. So the conditions upon leaving Seattle-Tacoma Airport, he set the conditions. Flaps down 15 degrees, landing gear down, fly low and slow, basically. And
he also asked for them to lower the air stairs before they took off. Okay. And Northwest told him no way because it was too dangerous. But that told us that possibly the hijacker wasn't planning on staying aboard anywhere near Reno. He was probably going to jump almost the minute he got to jump altitude.
Interesting. All right. Folks, we're talking to Robert Blevins. Excuse me, his website, adventurebooksofseattle.com, adventurebooksofseattle.com. Visit his website and also check his page out there of D.B. Cooper and also get his book on Amazon. And he's got a special on Amazon he's going to tell you about at some point in the program, just for listeners of this program tonight. What a great guy. Robert Blevins, you're listening to the Hagman Report. We're right back. Stay right where you're at. And by the way, tell a friend about our program. We'll be right back. Back, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. Our very special guest, Mr. Robert Blevins. He's got a website. His website is adventurebooksofseattle.com. He is, in my view, the foremost expert on the skyjacker known as D.B. Cooper. His investigative research, investigative findings, to me, are incredible. When you look at them and you balance out the information that he has developed on his own, by his own research, and compare it to what is being broadcast out there, some of the nonsense that's out there, Robert Blevins blows everything away, let me tell you. And, you know, people might say, why is this important? Well, look, we just passed the 45th anniversary of this. And think back, if you're a Generation Xer, okay, I understand, you're not going to know any of this. If you're a baby boomer, You remember perhaps the time of the 70s. Remember the movies of the week? Oh, Terror in the Skies. And movies like that, Mystery Movie of the Week, ABC, you know, presents. And this was really the earliest, one of the earliest skyjacking in American history. Skyjacking in American history. And, there was terror in the skies, obviously, with the passengers and crew of Flight 305, Northwestern Airlines. And, of course, this happened day before Thanksgiving, November 24th, 1971. And to this day, it remains the only unsolved skyjacking in American history. Well, I take issue with that, and I know Robert Blevins does as well, and we thank him for appearing on our show with us. So here we are. Now, we've just to summarize it, 2:45 p.m. Pacific time. The Flight 305 takes off Portland to Seattle, Tacoma. The guy by the name of D.B. Cooper walks on the aircraft carrying a briefcase. Inside looks like a bomb. He's wearing a shirt and a black tie with a tie clasp and smoking Raleigh cigarettes, drinking bourbon. Hands the stewardess a note saying, hey, I got a bomb here. I want 200 grand and some parachutes. Ultimately, he gets them. You heard it in the first segment of the program. And he landed at SeaTac, got refueled, passengers deplaned, all except for one of the stewardesses and the flight crew themselves, and D.B. Cooper, the man known as D.B. Cooper himself. That's where we're at. And, of course, the flight took off after getting refueled. Destination, well, wanted to go to Mexico City, but the terms of the flight were, no, flaps at 15 degrees, landing gear down, low airspeed, low altitude, And the flight crew said, hey, pal, look, buddy. You know, we can't make it to Mexico City, so choose someplace else. Reno's nice this time of year. You know, all right. So he said, all right, we'll do Reno.
Good point.
Yeah. All right, so here we go. And he was given four parachutes, and he had the $200,000 in a bag. He was a little miffed that the bag was one of those, you know, bags that the guys, what do they call them, armor car guys carry. And it wasn't in a knapsack, and probably miffed at himself for not really saying, you know, don't give me 23 pounds of 20s. But nonetheless, that's what he got. He got 20 non-sequential $20 bills. By the way, it was the Mitchell, John Mitchell, Attorney General under Nixon, who is their Department of Justice, who had recorded all the serial numbers, and that becomes important here in a little bit. So, and all these little details are kind of really significant that other places overlook and just blow off. But okay, so you've got a guy, and I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but you got a guy that's obviously that knows 727s apparently, knows parachutes apparently. Didn't quite think about the money. Well, give him that. But nonetheless, here we are. So they leave SeaTac late for the landing, of course. They leave SeaTac in the twilight of the night. And contrary to what people have heard, it wasn't a nasty, stormy, windy night. It was just like any other night. Maybe a little cold, but other than that, you know, weather was not an event, right?
That's right.
All right, so they're flying down toward Reno. Actually, they took off from SeaTac, and okay. So, what happens next?
Well, he seemed to know planes pretty well, but we're not sure he actually knew the 727 real well, because he knew that the stairs could be opened in flight, but he didn't know how to do it, and he had to get Mucklow to kind of show him. She said, "Just turn this handle, you know, and they'll drop." But he found out a couple of things, you know, later about how that worked. But anyway, yeah, he takes the other, the main chute? No. The other reserve chute, I believe, and he pops it. Oh, there is one thing here. I guess you could call me an expert on the area, the suspect that we investigated. But as far as, you know, there are these people out here with the minute details. They're always discussing the case, you know, all the minute stuff. Sure. About it. And on some of that, I have to defer to some of those people. They're a little bit better at that. But I have the basic things down pretty well. Anyway, so he pops this one parachute, starts cutting all these lines off it. He uses a lot of it he wraps around the half sack or leather sack, whatever you want to call it, with the handles a whole bunch of times, gets it really tight, and he ties a line to that, and then he ties that around his waist, and he left about, I don't know, maybe 6 or 8 feet of slack on it, you know.
Sure.
And Muckle showed him how to do the handle to open the stairs, and then she went forward and joined the rest of the flight crew, and they never saw Cooper again, although he did talk to them a couple of times on the interphone. But one thing that Mucklow thought that she was going to, he might make her jump, or that he was going to open the door with her back there, and she got really scared. And she said, we have oxygen on board if you need it. And he says, I know where it is, and I'll get it if I need it. And that was a clue, believe it or not, that why would he say he knew where it was, you know, and he would get it. Anyway.
Well, so, that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I didn't know that. All right.
Mucklow asked him, well, can you cut me off some cord and I'll tie myself to one of these seats? Because when you open the door, maybe, you know, the depression might throw me right out the door. She was pretty frightened, she said. He told her, don't worry about it, you know. He was having him, he depressurized the plane anyway. So she went forward and joined the crew.
Okay.
And then after that, I mean, some of it's going to be speculation, although some of it we know just from the facts of the flight. You know. But anyway, so he probably at this point, he did communicate with the crew. They called back there. The captain called back, asked him how things were going. Everything was okay. He said, I'm fine, I'm okay, and he hung up the phone. And then he opened the stairs, and they know when he opened the stairs. You know, there's a lot of debate about where he jumped. Maybe jumped way down by Reno. Maybe it was over the river in Portland. But Bill Ratajczak, the co-pilot, has told people multiple times, we know when Cooper jumped. We know where he jumped. We just don't know where he landed. That's what he's told people in interviews.
All
And the reason they know is when he pulled the handle and the stairs dropped, well, to Cooper's surprise, they didn't drop all the way down. The airflow, the opening was only maybe 2 to 3 feet. That's it. And so you're looking at this little 2 to 3 foot gap. And when he did that, the weight of the stairs, they could feel it up forward. And they called that in, you know, on the radio.
Sure.
And so what I think happened next was he grabbed the bank bag or the Tide bag, and he took the reserve parachute, the one that did not work. They accidentally gave him a small reserve that was a trainer. It didn't open. It was sewn shut. And it wasn't found on the plane. So what we think he did with it was he just threw it out the back right away because they never found it. And they never found the briefcase, so he may have done the same thing with that. I don't know.
Okay.
Then he took off the clip-on tie. He left it on the seat.
Yeah.
I should point out
the only thing left on the plane of Cooper's was the clip-on tie with the tie clasp, the cigarettes, and the bourbon glass he was drinking with bourbon was mixed with other glasses, so they couldn't tell which one was his, but nonetheless, okay, all right.
The popular myth, and it's been shown in movies and TV shows, I don't know how many times, is that Cooper just walked out there on those stairs and went to the bottom. And they would be dropping, by the way, from his weight when he's doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to the bottom and he just took a big Geronimo off the end. And I don't think that's what happened at all. And neither do some other parachute experts. They say if Cooper jumped without a reserve, only a crazy person would do that. And because of the stairs only opening 2 to 3 feet, like Radizak said, you know, because the airflow will hold them up, we think he turned around backwards and grabbed onto the rail with one hand and just backed down. You know, he would have to lean over almost into a crawl position and back down. And as he's doing this, the stairs are dropping. And then when he got to the bottom, he grabbed the ripcord on that NB8, that C9 canopy, and pulled it. And what would happen is the parachute's going to pop out and it's going to do a thing called squidding. And that means it floaters around, and then it's going to inflate, you know, and it's going to pull you right off there. And it's the opening shock isn't going to be that bad. And you also know your parachute works, and, you know, off you go.
All right.
He pulled him right off the stairs. Now, when he came off the stairs, the crew felt that too, because the stairs came flying back up, and there was a light in the cockpit that tells you when the air stairs are open. And Harold Anderson, the engineer, said that the light went off for a moment and then came back on all the way to Reno and never went off again. And what that told them was the stairs bounced back up, almost closed, and the light goes off, then they drop back down when they're, you know, to where they're going to be naturally, and Cooper was gone. And okay. So they marked that point, and they said, okay, that's when they jumped.
And it's my understanding it was like somewhere around 8:02 p.m., so it was early into that flight, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I think it was more like 8:12.
Okay.
I think it was about 8:12. Between, there's a lot of ambiguity about it. You know, I mean, the jet's going at 3 miles a minute. If they mark it at 1 minute and you're off by just 20 seconds, that's a mile in either direction. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, even if they get it to the minute, that's a 3 mile spread. And from 10,000 feet or so, you can drift up to a mile each direction. So even if they pinpointed it right to the just 1 minute, you're talking about a search area that's 3 miles long by 2 miles wide. That's 10 square miles, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and if it's, it, so they kind of know 8:11 to 8:13.
Well, okay, but it was closer to Seattle, Tacoma. It was closer to the airport. I mean, it was early on in the flight. It's certainly not in the outskirts of Reno, but in the outskirts of Seattle, Tacoma, right?
I'd say just over halfway between. Well, they think he jumped in the Ariel Amboy, Washington area.
Okay. Yeah, so there's a tavern, I think, in Ariel, Washington, that celebrates D.B. Cooper Day, I think, the Saturday after Thanksgiving every day. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So, okay, that's where they think he left based on everything. So, all right, so he's gone. He's in the wind, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And The plane continues on to Reno, right?
That's right.
I guess we'll follow the. Let's follow the plane, and we'll get back to Cooper. So the plane goes, lands in Reno. They never did bring the floppy staircase back up. I guess when they landed, that thing was torn to shreds, right?
It got damaged a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Sparks, they said, wasn't too bad.
All right. And the crew got off. They didn't, and the FBI surrounded them. I mean, bottom line was they realized that Cooper was not on board. And of course, you can see the video, folks, from the interviews, contemporaneous interviews with the, mm-hmm. with the captain and stuff. But, anything significant about that arena, or is that just kind of, okay, that's fine, you know, mark that and go on? Nothing
really. Well, They searched the plane, even in places where people don't generally go, and they found no trace of him.
Yeah.
Briefcase was gone, the non-working reserve, the parachute he jumped with that Tina saw him put on, let's see, that's one, two, one parachute was untouched.
Okay.
And the other one was popped over the seats where he'd cut the lines off of
right.
it.
Right. Okay. All right, so now we got a missing D.B. Cooper. We got a missing guy named D.B. Cooper. He's jumped out somewhere over the aerial Washington area in that vicinity. And as Robert Blevins, our guest, points out, man, you know, it's a big area if you don't know exactly precisely when. And there was a couple of aircraft jets that were trying to were scrambled over the flight, but that's like a needle in a haystack from the fact that you really can't. I mean, these jets can't. Slow to the at that time they couldn't do much. I guess they couldn't do much, right? I mean,
they were too fast. I think they used Thunder Chief 104s,
okay.
And they were they had to keep doing these big S turns, and they saw the plane on radar, I guess, but they didn't see anybody leave or anything.
Yeah, all right, okay. So okay, here you got D.B. Cooper sailing down to Earth. Ostensibly with a chute open, money, $200,000 tied to his body, free as a bird. Go figure. All right. So now the story takes a little bit of a murky turn. Robert, what do you think happened at this point?
Okay. I won't, okay. Without discussing a specific suspect yet, this is what I actually think happened. I think he jumped off the stairs by pulling, like I said, the ripcord off
right.
the stairs. And once he got on the ground, because the money was in a bag that so many people would recognize as a bank bag, you know, that armed cars, mm-hmm. guards carry, I think he took off the backpack, the parachute backpack. He disconnected the harness and the canopy from it, and then he used the container. It's just like a backpack when all those things are gone. Mm-hmm. I think he took money out of the bank bag and put it into the backpack. Now, he was carrying a Safeway-sized paper bag with him, you know, and nobody knows what was in it, but who knows, maybe clothes, maybe boots, maybe a map and compass, I don't know. But anyway, he had some items in there. He was in the bathroom for a long time. He may have... Who knows what? I don't know what he had in the bag. I'm not even going to speculate.
I'd be in the bathroom a long time too, but for other reasons.
Yeah.
But yeah. Okay.
Anyway, so he gets on the ground. This is what I think he did. I think he, like I said, disconnected the canopy and the harness from the container, stuffed the money in the container, put it on his back, took the canopy and buried it right there. You know, and there is some evidence to suggest that the FBI actually has that canopy right now. And you can ask me about that later, I guess.
But, okay. Yeah. Well, okay. All right. So, all right.
And then, then he walked out. And,
yeah.
And then we think he used quarters. You know, back in 1971, there was a payphone everywhere. They were like at every gas station on every little country road where there was a little store or something. They got one, you know. And I think he found the closest one and called a friend, and the friend came and got him.
Yeah, and folks, in case you're wondering, are we dragging this out? No, this is interesting. In case you're wondering, I'll just give kind of, I'm not going to give the ending away, but the bottom line is, did, you know, he get away with it? Absolutely. If Robert Blevins' investigative research is correct, and others as well, he absolutely did. He lived on. They never caught him. And although Robert Blevins does believe, and I believe that he's correct, that he knows exactly who this man is, and did he have help? Absolutely. Did others know about it? Absolutely. And did the FBI fumble this? Absolutely. So, okay. All right. And it's difficult now at this point, Robert. I'm going to kind of let you narrate or where you want to take this, because that's really the what happened. And I guess afterwards, we should note that after this happened, there were copycats. And I found this really interesting. Copycat jumpers. They actually arrested somebody who jumped, I guess, the following April. And they thought, okay, well, this guy's D.B. Cooper because of the exact same M.O. and all this. But no, it wasn't. So how do you want to go from here? Because I don't want to give away the ending. But I want you to walk through your investigative steps. Really cool. This is really neat. How you really uncovered all this stuff. So,
Skip Porteous, the investigator. Mm-hmm. I told him, okay, send me. He said, I got this big package of confidential files on our suspect and friends that he knew, you know, like that. And I'll send them to you. You can take a look. And I would like you to hunt some of these people down. Just interview them, you know, okay. So I started looking at this stuff, and I wasn't sure. People have been trying to solve the Cooper case for years and years, and I didn't think my chances were any better than anybody else's, and I wasn't even a professional investigator. But I looked at the first name on the list was, let me think who it was. Oh, yeah, an elderly lady who lived on a place called Fox Island, Washington. It's a nice neighborhood. And it was, she was a very good friend of the suspect. Okay. And so she had an unlisted phone number. I couldn't get it. So I made a cold call drive to her house. And I get out there and I knock on this door. It's a waterfront, really nice waterfront cabin. And this big guy comes to the door, about 20 years old. He looked like he played linebacker for the Seattle Seahawks. I said, well, I'm here to see this lady, you know. And he says, oh, that's my grandmother. And I told him, I'm here to ask her some questions. What I was telling people at first, I couldn't just go and say, oh, yeah, I'm checking out this guy because he might be D.B. Cooper. What I would do is I would give the name of the suspect and say, I'm researching a biography about his life.
Okay.
And so he goes back inside, talks to grandma, comes back out, and I was allowed in. She said, oh, yeah, come on in. And we sat there and talked about the suspect for about an hour and a half. I got some pictures of her, and she was very open. I mean, she knew who the suspect was, and she had known him at the time of the hijacking. In fact, this guy had loaned her $5,000 in cash 5 months after the hijacking, so she could move she and her four children out of a house where she was staying with somebody else in Bonnie Lake, Washington, and the suspect only made $512 a month, so I kind of wondered about how he was able to do that. And then I finally admitted to her really why I was there, you know, and she wasn't even surprised. I told her, well, we're investigating, you know, this guy because we think he could be D.B. Cooper. She goes, oh, well, you know, some of my friends thought he was Cooper back when it happened for a while, but he seems like such a nice guy. We just kind of wrote it off later, you know. Okay, and I pushed over a picture of the tie that he left on board the aircraft with the tie clip.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I pushed it over to her, and it didn't have any markings on it. I said, does this mean anything to you? And she said, well, I don't know about the tie, but I've seen that clip before, and she named the suspect. I saw him wear that several times. And she says, but not after the hijacking, you know?
Okay.
So that was pretty good evidence. And from there I moved on, and I went to interview her brother, who lived up in Port Angeles, Washington. He was named by Skip as a possible accomplice.
Okay.
So, but Skip wasn't really sure. So I go to his house, and I give him the same story. You know, I'm doing a bio on the suspect. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we said, he was really funny though. When I came to the door, he had this other lady living with him, and all she did was look at me through the picture window for like 10 minutes. And finally, I held up my business card to her, and I, you know, said, and then he comes to the door and he says, what do you want? I said, well, I'm doing a biography on you, you know. And he goes, oh, him, you know, and he named him. He goes, oh, yeah, I worked with him in the Aleutians, and we did this and we did that, and we were friends for a lot of years, you know. And he was telling me their adventures together, and he said, well, I used to work for Boeing on the 727 and also worked with the suspect, you know, mm-hmm. at these other places. And then he stopped. He told me all this stuff, and then he just stopped. And then he looked at me and he goes, why are you here again? Why are you asking about, you know, he named the guy.
Right.
And I said, well, I'll be up front of you. I said, because he's a suspect in the Cooper case, D.B. Cooper case. And this guy turned white. I mean, he just went white as a ghost, and he didn't want to say another word. And he said, I'll send you some pictures of me and him together, but I gotta go.
Yeah. Okay.
He was frightened, you know. So he went back in and just shut the door, and I went home.
Okay.
And
Robert, yeah. let me stop yes. you here, because folks, remember, this hijacking was 1971, November of 1971. Yeah. So Robert, when were you doing these interviews? What was it?
I mean, it started in the first interview I did was in January of 2009, I think.
All right, so
it pretty much went on for a year and a half.
So almost 40 years later, you're poking around and people are getting nervous, basically.
Yeah.
All right.
Well,
Well, go ahead.
The important thing is also, I really should have included this. When I told him the stuff about D.B. Cooper, the first thing he did was point to his ex-wife who lived out in Eastern Washington. And he said, you should talk to her. They were thick as thieves. You know, I think she helped him do it. You know, and I thought, boy, that's a weird thing to say. I mean, you're just going to accuse your ex-wife of being an accomplice in the hijacking? You know.
Let's throw her under the bus. Why don't we? Oh, my goodness. Okay, this is great. And by the way, we're about a minute off from the break. And when we come back, and feel free to at any time to name the suspect, because it's kind of hard to dance around the name. I suspect you're going to want to name the suspect, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Because and this is fascinating, folks, how Mr. Blevins went through this. And you know, the History Channel stuff and the other programs, they don't do justice to this. Not even close. And even to the extent where what you're going to hear next is going to be so engaging. And trust me when I tell you that I believe that this is almost an airtight case, and the FBI has the ability to indeed solve this or to close the books on this. We are talking with Mr. Robert Blevins, his website, adventurebooksofseattle.com. There you can get all sorts of information there. Bob, we have about a minute before the music starts. You've got a special offer at adventurebooksofseattle.com, or what's your offer with books or papers? Your Kindle.
Pretty much everything we publish for the Kindle. I think it's 14, maybe 16 publications. They've all been put on a Kindle countdown deal starting today for a week.
Fantastic. So you can get it for 99 cents, right?
Yes, that's right.
All right. So special for the program, go to adventurebooksofseattle.com. But the Kindle countdown starts today. How gracious of a man to do that, offer you that material. And of course, we're talking with Mr. Robert Blevins, adventurebooksofseattle.com. Folks, you're listening to the Hagman Report on this coming on this day before Christmas Eve, on Christmas Eve Eve, right?
Right.
Christmas Eve Eve. Anyway, folks, we just really getting into this, and what a fascinating story this is. 45 years ago, just celebrated that anniversary, Robert Blevins is the man, I believe, has broken the case along with Skip Porteous, but Robert Blevins did the footwork, which you're going to hear when we come back. You're not going to want to miss, because this ties it all together, and some kick-butt investigative work, let me tell you. Stay right where you're at. The Hagman and Hagman Report. HagmanReport.com, HagmanandHagman.com for show information as well.